You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
It's the beginning of the best sports time of the year. This is our final Sunday without NFL football. The college football season is in full swing. Some really interesting matchups and interesting results. Week one yesterday throughout the country. It is September, so we have two baseball teams in a pennant race right now, which it's been New York City, of course. It's been such an interesting season for them because at one point it looked like we were going to have one team in the pennant race, and then a couple months later, it still looked like we were going to have one New York team in the pennant race, but it was the other team than it was earlier in the season. And now very clearly, we've got, once again, two baseball teams in this town in the pennant race. So everything's on the table. 1-800-919-3776. You got the U.S. Open going on. We just spoke about the Tour Championship final round coming up later today in Atlanta with not only $15 million on the line, but the PGA Tour Player of the Year Award. So 1-800-919-3776 is the number to call. It's Pat O'Keefe in for Anita Marks. Before we get into a couple of initial thoughts, let me just remind you that this 98.7 ESPN tennis update is brought to you by Total Orthopedic, spine and sports medicine, Long Island's premier orthopedic practice. Whether you have a sports injury, an age-related ailment, or something far more complex, their award-winning team are the experts at getting you back to you. Interesting day in Flushing yesterday. You have the top seed Novak Djokovic moving on to the round of 16. The sixth seed Matteo Berrettini, the Italian. The fourth seed Alexander Zverev. It was a really good day for the Americans, though. 22nd seed Riley Opelka advances to the round of 16. And Jensen Brooksby upsets the 21st seed in the men's bracket. So in a five-set match where he had to come from behind to win the final two sets. So Brooksby is moving on as well. And how about the job by Shelby Rogers upending the number one ranked women's player in the field, Ashley Barty from Australia? Rogers wins it in a tiebreaker in the third set. So that's your U.S. Open update. And now your baseball update. The Yankees have, well, they've been disappointing. And that's despite the 13-game winning streak that I think they're still dining off of, by and large. The 13-game winning streak, if you examine it game by game, it had the feel. Remember the old Yankees? We're talking, I mean, this is a good week to talk about the old Yankees because one of those old Yankees is going into the Hall of Fame on Wednesday in Derek Jeter, and we'll have some thoughts on him as the morning progresses. But remember the old Yankees? They just seemed like no matter what, you know, the uniform or the hat or the stadium or whatever it was, they just throw their gloves and their bats out there on the field and they would find a way to win. Even if they weren't playing their best, there would be something during the course of the game that even when they weren't on their game that particular day would help them win. Now, the difference between the old Yankees that, you know, so many of you listeners, you know and love or know and hate, the difference between them and this current team is that those periods of time when they weren't playing that well were few and far between. By and large, they won championships. They won 100 games every year. They won division titles because they were consistently good, okay? That's not what this Yankees team is. So during the 13-game winning streak, there was an element of winning the same way the old Yankees used to win. There was good pitching, okay? There was timely hitting. There wasn't consistent hitting. There was timely hitting. And there was some good luck involved and some good fortune involved, and that's how you win 13 games in a row. There was also a soft spot of the schedule. So now what you're seeing since the winning streak came to an end, when you lose two straight games to Oakland, you lose two out of three games in Anaheim, and now you've split the first two games with the Orioles this season, you are starting to see the same Yankees team that was so frustrating the first 2.5 to 3 months of the regular season. The one that Yankee fans hated. I mean, this has been, and we'll get into the Mets because for the Mets, it's been a roller coaster of a month. For the Yankees, it really has been a roller coaster of a season because think about the Yankees the first 2.5, 3 months. It was, in mine and many people's estimations, the most hated Yankees team by their own fans that I can remember. I mean, I was on this show weekend after weekend after weekend talking about how old and unathletic and stale and rigid and right-handed they are. And when they weren't getting the pitching and they weren't getting the relief pitching to mask their offensive deficiencies. It was extremely frustrating as this team with so much talent on paper was struggling to keep its head above 500 when the Rays and the Red Sox looked young and athletic and vibrant, and the Yankees were the opposite of that. And then right before the All-Star break, that started to change a little bit. The Yankees started to put together a decent stretch of baseball against the Mariners, against the Astros, against the Red Sox. The only blemish during that period of time was on the rare occasion that the Yankees did lose during that portion of the season. The losses were so rip-your-heart-out gut-wrenching that it felt like three losses when it was only one. And it felt like the Yankees would win three games in a row, but then Aroldis Chapman would blow a game in the ninth inning and it would just be a brutal loss, and it felt like you lost all three of those games. You actually didn't. Despite those losses, one thing I can say about this Yankees team is they never let those horrible losses, whether it was the Altuve game in Houston, whether it were the games in Fenway Park where Brooks Kreisky throws four wild pitches in the 10th inning, or Domingo Germán loses a no-hitter in the eighth inning and then loses the game by giving up five runs. Those losses never seemed to carry over. So the Yankees were actually able to build some momentum despite those losses, and then they were significantly fortified at the trade deadline, okay? But were they significantly fortified at the trade deadline? Now, the trade deadline moves, and the biggest two were Joey Gallo and Anthony Rizzo. And interestingly, that was kind of the point where the Yankees season took a turn. But the other interesting thing about that is it wasn't because of Joey Gallo or Anthony Rizzo. Initially, it was because of Rizzo. He comes in that first series against Tampa Bay. I think he had a home run in three straight games. He knocked in runs in three straight games. Terrific glove at first base. And then unfortunately for the Yankees and for Rizzo, he went away for a while as he tested positive for COVID-19. Now, since he's been back, let's be honest, he hasn't been good. Since Joey Gallo has come to New York, he's been awful. I mean, he's been awful. It's nice to see a left-handed bat in the lineup to balance things out. It's nice to see he's a terrific outfielder. He's athletic. It's kind of unusual to see that type of guy in a Yankees uniform these days. It's nice to see that being added to the Yankees outfield. But at the plate, he has been awful. So, yeah, the timing works out that when they get Rizzo and they get Gallo, their season kind of turned around a little bit. But it hasn't been because of either of those guys. And I know Joey Gallo hit a huge home run yesterday, and he's hit a couple of big ones. He's hit a couple of big home runs. He's hit a couple of big doubles. But that's pretty much all of his hits. I mean, you accept Joey Gallo for what he is. He's a guy who can hit 30 home runs, but he's a guy who's going to strike out a lot and hit around 210. I mean, can we get 210? He's batting 130. He's batting 130 as a Yankee. He's been here for over a month. Where do I sign for 210? I mean, imagine what a difference it would make if this guy was hitting 210 as opposed to 130. That's how bad he's been. Okay, so despite those new additions into the lineup, you are still starting to see the Yankees lineup not produce runs on a consistent basis. So what was the other difference during the winning streak? The starting pitching. There was about a month and a half, 2 month stretch where Jameson Taillon was as good as any starting pitcher in the American League. Gerrit Cole was out for much of that winning streak. Now, he's the Cy Young Award favorite, but even without Gerrit Cole, you had performances from Nestor Cortez, Taillon picking up the slack. Luis Gil has started three games in the majors and still has not allowed a run. So a lot of this was done with smoke and mirrors. It wasn't done by the top of the roster, except with the notable exception of Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. They have done their jobs, and I don't know what the reason is. I'm sure it's related to the fact that he's playing the field on a somewhat regular basis, but ever since Giancarlo Stanton put a glove back on his hand, he has been a different guy at the plate. And Judge has been fantastic all season long. But up and down the Yankees lineup, that's about it. So you're not getting much offensively. The starting pitching is now inconsistent, okay, because Jameson Taillon has come back to earth. He's resembling the guy who was very frustrating the first 2 months of the season. The bullpen is just overused, and I've been saying this since the beginning of the season. The Yankees' bullpen is overused, and when I looked at the construction of this roster before the season, and this is even before they lost some key guys to injuries, it was pretty clear to me that Aaron Boone could not manage this pitching staff the way he had managed it his first 3 years. His first 2 or 3 years, the Yankees had terrific depth in their bullpen, whether it was Chad Green or Zach Britton, Aroldis Chapman. They just had a lot of arms out there who you could mix and match and get a day off for a guy here or not get a day off for a guy here. That has not been the case this season, and that's been compounded by the fact that you don't have Zach Britton, you don't have Darren O'Day, who was supposed to be a key right-handed arm out of the bullpen. So who do you trust? Seriously, who do you trust right now in the Yankees bullpen? You don't trust the closer. I mean, he had another meltdown, might be harsh for yesterday, but look, he lost the game yesterday. The Yankees have this terrific comeback, and then Chapman comes out, and he loads the bases with nobody out. He almost pitched out of it, but he didn't. And it's time to take a look at Aroldis Chapman, especially since he came back from Chicago. It's time to take a look at what Aroldis Chapman has been as the Yankees closer since 2017. Well, in 2019, the Yankees season ended when Chapman gave up a home run to Jose Altuve. In 2020, the Yankees season ended in a tie game in a decisive Game 5 when Chapman gave up a home run to Tampa Bay, to Brasso. And now, I think a big part of the story of this Yankees season, and we talk about the gut punch losses over and over and over again, how many of those has Aroldis Chapman been responsible for? So you have to ask yourself the question, if the Yankees do get into October, and it still looks pretty good that they will, their schedule the last month of the season is not overly difficult. But then again, the Orioles are the worst team in baseball, and the Yankees have trouble beating them. So nothing is for certain with this team. But even if the Yankees do get into the postseason, and even if the starting pitching starts clicking 1 through 5, and even if the lineup starts clicking 1 through 9, the bullpen, I don't see the bullpen being at a point this season where it's not a major concern for the Yankees. And I think ultimately, and this is a hard pill to swallow for Yankee fans because they, more so than any other fan base, has not had to deal with this. But I think ultimately, the Yankees bullpen is going to be the undoing for this team in October because there's nowhere to turn. You know, Loaisiga's been the best guy, and he's been a terrific find this season as he's really stepped forward, and he looks like he's a really good piece for the future. And like I said, he's been the best guy, but even he hasn't been without his moments. You know, Chad Green is not what he was 2-3 years ago. Chapman clearly isn't what he was. Zach Britton, even if he comes back from injury, isn't what he was. There's not a lot out there. And if you think back to the ALDS last season when the Yankees lost in that frustrating 5-game series to Tampa Bay, one of the biggest differences was Tampa Bay kept bringing all of these guys out of the bullpen. They all seemed to throw 98, 99, 100 miles an hour. You never heard of any of them, but it was power arm after power arm after power arm and guys who pounded the strike zone. The Yankees do not have that. There's a number of reasons for that. They're old. They're on the other side of their primes. And they're just simply overworked. I mean, think about it. The Yankees right now are in a stretch of playing 20 days in a row, okay? They're 2 games, 2 days into that stretch, starting with Friday night against Baltimore. So far, on Friday night, they used 5 pitchers. Excuse me. Friday night, they used 6 pitchers. Yesterday, they used 5 pitchers. That's how you're starting off a stretch of 20 consecutive days. They cannot keep up this pace. So you could point to a number of spots on the Yankees roster. We'll go through all of them. But the bullpen, ultimately, I'm afraid, is going to be the death knell for this team.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Time for the Yankees Injury Report, brought to you by Total Orthopedic Spine and Sports Medicine. The injury report, not as long as it has been earlier this season. Gio Urshela was out yesterday. He's day-to-day with an injured hand. Luis Severino is, this is according to Marley Rivera of ESPN.com, yesterday reporting that Severino is doing well, is expected to return to the mound by next weekend to mound work, not to the mound as far as pitching in games. So, look, it's getting late in the season. At this point, with all of the setbacks Severino continues to have, it doesn't appear overly likely that he could be a piece that you can count on. It seems like everything needs to go right for Severino between now and when he would return to the mound. Zach Britton is done. He's going to undergo surgery next week to have a bone chip removed from his left elbow. Michael King is on a rehab assignment with AAA Scranton Wilkes-Barre, so he could be a piece out of the bullpen down the stretch and even into the postseason. The Yankees could still use Domingo Germán back. He played catch a couple of days ago, is in line to throw a bullpen session. Again, he could be a piece at the back end of the rotation or in the bullpen to add some depth there. It looks like Miguel Andujar and Clint Frazier are both likely done for the season. And see, I said the Yankees injury list wasn't as long as it was earlier in the season, and it wasn't. But it still seemed pretty lengthy. And that is the Yankees Injury Report, brought to you by Total Orthopedics Spine and Sports Medicine, Long Island's premier orthopedic practice. Total Ortho Express is Long Island's premier orthopedic immediate care. No appointment needed. Time doesn't heal wounds. They do. All right, let's go to the phones. 1-800-919-3776 and start off with Spike in St. Pete. Good morning, Spike.
Good morning, Pat. Hope all is well. And I'm living in the armpit of COVID, so I keep away and have you guys to keep me company.
Thank you, Spike. Stay safe, please.
Yeah, look, yeah, I'm trying my best, man. My county's inundated with this. People just don't listen, but nothing I can do. So here's what I feel about the Yankees. I know you're a hoops guy and you're a sports guy. Talking to Ty about this a little bit. I can substantiate that basketball and baseball have similarities. They play twice as many games in baseball, roughly, but with all the traveling in basketball, you know, you wear out. That's why there's rest and so on and so forth. But I'm substantiating this. If you don't have a closer that's 90% effective minimum, it's very, very razor thin to win. It really is. Chapman's a tough watch. He's a tough watch. And when Sanchez let that ball go, whether he should have gotten it or not, so be it. This team's made up analytically, and that's why Gallo's so frustrating batting second. He probably makes the least amount of contact in the major leagues. He's first in strikeouts and third in walks, and the rest of it, you know, and he's deteriorated since he's come here. That's what happens. But he's a terrific plus fielder, and he'll win your game here and there. I just thought, look, Chapman gets trouble getting pitches over. If he can't get his fastball over, you can't close with him. You just can't. And I don't know who you go to. I always forget the lefty from Baltimore. I never remember his name. He's injured now.
Zach Britton.
Yeah. Britton. I always forget his name. You know, brain freeze. And I don't know what you do with. You throw it to LaWisica? That's a tough one. He's pitched great. Green, I think, has been, you know, consistently inconsistent. But a lot of these teams, and I'm 5 minutes away from the Tampa Stadium. It's an embarrassment to have under 8,000 people there Friday night for the Boston game. Embarrassment. Don't tell me about traffic, please. Total embarrassment. That team doesn't lose because of their bullpen. They also strike out a lot. And I think the Yankees will just have to get it together and figure out the back end of the bullpen. Otherwise, they'll be fine. The big guys are going to hit. And the last thing, and thanks for the time, have a great holiday weekend. Can the people back off on Stanton now? He never said a peep when he was criticized. I know when he looks bad, he looks horrible. But I give him a lot of props, man. I'm telling you, I'd love to hear your opinion on it. He never said a word. He never complained. And I think him and Judge are having tremendous, tremendous years. And maybe it's the fielding. So have a wonderful program. Looking forward to listening.
Thanks a lot, Spike. And thanks for the call. As always, have a great weekend. A couple of things there. I agree with Stanton on his point on Stanton. And this was kind of brought to light last week after the Javi Baez and Francisco Lindor incident with the Mets fans and not being receptive to their boos. People, talk show hosts like myself have been extremely, extremely hard on Giancarlo Stanton since he's come to New York. And I've said this, and look, he's playing great right now. Despite that, I just think that his presence on this team following what they had cooking in 2017, I think it really stopped a lot of their momentum. It made them more right-handed. It made them less flexible, both in terms of their salary cap and what they could do positionally, because he kind of clogged up the DH spot. The fact that he's been playing in the field right now has helped alleviate that glut, and it's also helped him at the plate, so that's huge. I still say that his presence in 2018 really stopped a lot of the momentum that, you know, the Judges and the Sanchezes and the Severinos, and I know Severino's been injured, but those young Yankees had going. That being said, let's look at what it is, all right? He has, along with Aaron Judge, carried this team offensively for the last month and a half to 2 months during their best stretch of the season. He also performed in October last year. What did he have, 5 straight games with a home run? 6 straight games with a home run? And people got on him because he finished the season by striking out. Okay? That happens. He's never said a word. He really hasn't. People in all walks, whether it's fans, whether it's broadcasters, whomever, have been extremely critical of Giancarlo Stanton. And look, maybe this isn't something that guys should be given extra credit for, but in light of what happened with these two idiots from the Mets, Baez and Lindor, look, not everybody handles it the same way. So, yeah, he does deserve credit for that. As far as the Yankees go and their bullpen, which is their biggest issue, I think it has to be a bullpen by committee. And I go back to the Atlanta game on August 24th when Aaron Boone took Aroldis Chapman out of the game after he had walked in a run and the bases were loaded for Freddie Freeman, one out away from victory. And he brings in Wandy Peralta, and they had a classic, classic at-bat. Peralta, the lefty, against the reigning National League MVP, and Peralta ends up getting him to fly out to left field to end the game. That's what the Yankees have. The Yankees cannot have a closer right now. They really can't. Aaron Boone needs to manage this completely differently, and other teams have started to do this, including the Rays. The Rays don't have a set closer. They have a guy who gets that opportunity more than others, but they also go with who's rested, and they go with the hot hand. And you're at the point now, and not just with Chapman, with Green, with Loaisiga, because he's not perfect. Whoever you deem the guy to bring in the ninth inning in that game, you got to have somebody warming up. You just do. Because if one guy doesn't have it, maybe the other guy will have it. And in the Atlanta game that I just alluded to on the 24th of August, the Yankees had a 2-run cushion. If you have a 2-run cushion or a 3-run cushion, you don't have to just throw your 33-year-old closer out there because he has the resume and he's done it before and just hope that he has it on that particular night. That is far too risky considering how he has pitched the second half of this season. Because there are still days where Chapman can get it done, but there are plenty of days where he cannot. Like, it would have been nice yesterday when he loads the bases. It would have been nice to be able to have an option to bring out of the bullpen. And I know Chapman did a pretty good job after that. He was the beneficiary of a kind of questionable strike call, but you'll take it. And he only got out of that situation by allowing one run. But there can't be a set closer anymore. You know, if Green is rested and pitching well, you give him the opportunity. But the first sign of trouble, you can't trust anybody to work their way out of it. Nobody on this roster, as they're pitching right now, has earned that trust. And these games are far too important. Everything seemed great after the 13-game winning streak, right? You pretty much had not only locked up a wild card spot, but it was a foregone conclusion, Yankee fans, that you were going to host that wild card game against either Boston or Oakland. Well, guess what? Boston's a half game back right now. Oakland's closing in. They're 4.5 back. And you are all ready to chase down Tampa Bay in September and try and win the division. That ain't happening. You're 7.5 games behind. So these games are far too important.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Yanks and Mets both in action a few hours from now. Yankees, the rubber match of their 3-game series at home against the Orioles. It's been a disappointing weekend so far for the Yanks. It's really been a disappointing week since their 13-game winning streak came to an end. They lose 2 straight to Oakland. They lose 2 out of 3 to the Angels. And now they have split the first 2 against the Orioles. Corey Kluber against Keegan Aiken. Mets also at 1 p.m. Taiwan Walker against Josiah Gray. That game is in our nation's capital. This tennis update is brought to you by Squarespace, the website building and e-commerce e-commerce platform designed to grow your dream business. Couple of featured matchups in the early portion of today. At the U.S. Open, noon, Arthur Ashe Stadium, fourth round of the women's singles, fifth seeded Alina Svitolina taking on number 12, Simona Halep, and that will be followed by the second seed in the men's bracket, Daniil Medvedev, against Great Britain's Daniel Evans. So that's your tennis update. Yesterday was a pretty good day for young Americans at the U.S. Open on both the men and women's sides of the bracket. I want to make a final Gary Sanchez point, and of course we can continue the conversation if you wish. But look, let's be honest. A couple of callers ago mentioned that Gary Sanchez is the problem. And Ty, hop in here with me if you can, because you watch these guys. I mean, I think at this point we know what Sanchez is. I mean, let's go through Sanchez's time. He, you know, the Yankees signed him as a very, very, very young prospect. I think he was 16 years old. They gave him a big signing bonus. He was in the minors as their catcher of the future for years. And then, you know, the great sell-off of 2016 when the Yankees traded Chapman and they traded Andrew Miller and they traded Carlos Beltran. They brought up Aaron Judge. They brought up Tyler Austin. And they inserted Gary Sanchez as the starting catcher for Brian McCann. He was incredible. He came up, he played 53 games, he had 20 home runs, 42 runs batted in, an OPS of 1,032, and he was just 23 years old. And he had a rocket for an arm. You didn't really notice any defensive deficiencies at that point. And then he backed that up with a 2017 season where I think everything seemed to click up and down the Yankees roster. And in 2017, Sanchez played 122 games. He batted .278. He had 33 homers. He hit 90 RBIs. He was really good in the postseason. And then since then, look, a .186 batting average, .232, .147, and .213. Those are his batting averages the last four seasons. And the power numbers have been down except for 2019 when he made an all-star team again, had 34 homers and 77 RBIs. But look, three of the last four seasons, Ty. I mean, .186 batting average, 18 homers, 53 runs batted in. I know last year was a shortened season, but he hit .147 with 10 home runs in 49 games. And this year, where is the power? I mean, 18 homers, 43 RBIs. We got a month left in the season. He's batting .213. And those numbers with his defense do not say that he deserves a spot in this lineup. So I think we know what this guy is. He's 28 years old now. And unfortunately, I don't think he's the guy going forward.
You know what we forget? We forget that... What was that? 5 years ago, 2016, 2017, when Judge and Sanchez both came up, there was like a legitimate conversation as to, you know, who was the better player between these two guys. Because Gary, the value in having a catcher who was good defensively and could hit 30 home runs, you know, as one of the best offensive players in the sport, like that was tremendous. And I go back, and here's what told me all I needed to know about Gary Sanchez. The biggest game of the season the Yankees played last year was Game 5. Against Tampa, Gerrit Cole on the mound, Higashioka started. And I understand, you know, that's Cole's personal catcher, but it's the biggest game of the season. Higashioka in his career is a 183 hitter. So you got essentially benched for a guy hitting below 200 in Game 5 of the Division Series. So to me, that just told me that the Gary Sanchez era was over. Like, you know, we're going to wait out the contract. This guy's not going to be, at some point he's going to either be traded or, you know, something's going to happen with him. And it's just very disappointing to see us go from where we were in 2016, where, you know, could he be the best player on the team, to now it's like he's just like a waste of an at-bat every time he's up there.
You're absolutely right. Look, 2016 was such a fun time for the Yankee fan. I know they didn't make the playoffs, but it was really the only time in really a lot of Yankee fans' lifetime of a certain age where the Yankees actually were committing to a youth movement. And Sanchez, not Judge, to your point, was at the front of that youth movement. I mean, what he did in the second half of the year in 2016,
incredible.
20 homers in 53 games. I mean, the excitement around Sanchez. Now, fast forward to 2017, because then you go into that season and all the talk was about the Baby Bombers. And that was, I would say, in the post 2009 era of Yankees baseball, so since their most recent championship, I would say that the 2017 was by far the most likable.
Without question.
Absolutely. And at the beginning of the season, it's funny to think about this now. You know who the last guy to make the roster was?
Who was it?
It was Aaron Judge. There was legitimate question whether or not Judge had earned himself a spot on the opening day roster in 2017, because Judge came up in 2016, a little after Sanchez, and I remember his first game. Judge and Tyler Austin hit back-to-back home runs. Remember that? And
yeah,
Judge's went off the, I don't know what it is now, it was the Mohegan Sun restaurant then. It was incredible. But then Judge really struggled down the stretch of that season.
Struck out a ton.
A ton. And you're like, you know, he can hit, but like, what is this guy going to be? And that was still in Girardi's mind and Cashman's mind when they put together the 2017 roster. He made the team. We know what happened. He hit 52 home runs, was the runner-up for AL.
Should have been the league MVP.
Agreed. He was the runner-up for that to Jose Altuve. And then Sanchez was also terrific that year. So, yeah, you're right. 2017, it was like, wow, you got these two young right-handed hitters in the middle of your lineup. And then they were both really good in the postseason, too,
Sanchez,
that Astros series.
At that ALCS, I want to say it was game 4. Yankees trailing 2-1 in the series. They win.
Yep.
They 2-0 in the series. They win game 3. Game 4, they're trailing in the 8th inning, and Gary Sanchez like clears the bases.
I think it was the day game.
Yeah, it was the day game.
Yes,
it was. Clears the bases. So they tie the series 2-2, and then, you know, they win game 5. Then they ultimately lose the series. But there's confidence because, you know, we didn't expect that to happen. But now look at what we have going forward. They fired Girardi, and they're supposed to take off, and then it just never happens.
You know, one of the things they said about Girardi was that he didn't see eye to eye with Sanchez.
Well, because he dared to say that Gary Sanchez needed to play better.
How's that worked out for Sanchez since?
How dare the manager come out and say that one of his players just simply needs to be better? How dare you say that, Girardi?
And he hasn't been. And 2018 is really where it turned around for Sanchez. Because his defense, he continued to struggle with that, and then all of a sudden he was struggling at the plate too.
And we just kept making excuses for him. Yes. Remember, it was like, oh, is it his eyesight?
Yes.
Maybe he can't see.
We're still making excuses. We're still holding on to 2016 and 2017 and the first half of 2019. It's been long enough, unfortunately. And the point I'm making here in the larger context of the Yankees, which is worrisome, I'm starting to see. Now, it's too early to say this is what's happening, but I'm starting to see some of the same trends in Gleyber Torres, which is very concerning because 2 years ago, Torres was can't miss. But if it can happen to Gary Sanchez, let me ask you this. Torres's first 2 years, was he terrific offensively?
Oh, he was brilliant.
Now, is Torres a good defensive player?
He's not.
Is he hitting well?
He's not.
Is he athletic? I mean, it sounds like you're describing Gary Sanchez just at a different position.
Yeah, and he's been, you know, riddled with injury. That's scary. Now that you just said that, I'm starting to see similarities.
There's some similarities.
It's a little unfair, but what happens sometimes in sports is like when a guy struggles consistently and develops bad habits, you start to associate it to some degree with laziness. Like a lack of effort, and it feels like that happened with Sanchez. Like he's lazy, he's not trying hard enough. He's like, there's no effort, lackluster, and we're starting to see that same trend with Torres, who, by the way, was actually playing pretty well before he got hurt.
Yes, he was. He was hitting well.
Yeah, he was hitting very well before he got hurt. So, you know, don't want to kill him just yet. Just got back this week, didn't play yesterday.
I know,
but. This next month for him is critical.
Well, because if Torres isn't going to hit, then put Velasquez out there because he's a better fielder. He's faster. He's more athletic. He's more energetic.
Do that if you're Aaron Boone.
I'm just saying.
It's like I know that since the Yankees started playing well, like we haven't discussed his job security. But think about it. Like if the Yankees go out and lose that wild card game, is he definitely coming back?
I wouldn't say so.
So knowing that. It's the biggest game we will have played in as the manager. You're going to bench Gleyber Torres Velasquez has been great. It's been a fun story, but you're going to start him in the biggest game of the season?
Which, back to your point, Ty, is why this is a very big month for Gleyber Torres. Because we all know, look, Velasquez is what he is, and he has a great story. The Yankees are better. The best case scenario for the Yankees is for Gleyber Torres to hit like he did his first 2 seasons in the majors. All right, 1-800-919-3776. Let's see what Jason in Warwick has to say about this. Jason, good morning.
What's up, fellas? So it's funny about Gary because when you bring him up and you say, well, he's so good about defense, when I say this to my friends, they're like, well, he's got a rocket arm. Great, dude, he's got a rocket arm. But back in 2016 and 17, he was letting up big mistakes. I was like, let's get rid of this guy at his peak. This, his stock is so high right now. I would love to get a pitcher because we needed one back then. We didn't do it. We kept him, and now he's kind of just, like you guys are saying, he's just like, what are we doing with him? Now his value is nothing.
I agree. I don't think you're getting much for him. He's probably going to end up leaving as a free agent whenever his contract is done. But I don't agree with you. I mean, 2016, 2017, Jason, the way he was hitting the ball, I mean, think about this. His first two seasons, 53 home runs in 175 games as a catcher. I mean, the Yankee fan really That's thought amazing. They had something special.
That's amazing as a catcher. And yeah, agreed. So 2016, I'll give. But 17, you started to see these, like, all these mistakes. And
I agree, but let me just jump in there, Jason. I totally agree, and that was a big part of the conversation in the postseason. And Sanchez, if you remember, is one of the reasons that Major League Baseball instituted the rule that you can only visit the mound now six times during a game, because it got to the point in the playoffs he was literally going to the mound after every pitch because he couldn't get on the same page with his pitcher. And that led to the conversation about Girardi. But all of that being said, Jason, if the guy's going to hit 33 home runs and knock in 90 in 122 games as your catcher, you could live with the defense that he was giving you. The only problem is since 2017, he hasn't been close to that at the plate.
Well, that's my point. So that's, you know, 5 years ago. So what we should have sold him at a high. I know we could always, you know, hindsight is 2020, but we should have gotten rid of him. And I'm a Yankee fan, bleed blue. I said, this guy, we should probably get a pitcher for him. Everyone told me I was crazy.
I would have said you were crazy, too, if you wanted to trade him after 2017, to be honest. And thanks for the call. I think this is the definition of hindsight is 2020. I don't think anybody foresaw him being this kind of hitter the last four seasons that he's turned into. If he was the same guy that he was in 2016 and 2017, you could live with his defense. Ken in Bridgewater. What's up, Ken? Ken, are you there? We lost Ken. Pat O'Keefe in for Anita, 1-800-919-3776. Yanks, Orioles, 1 o'clock, the stadium. Yankees' schedule down the stretch isn't overly taxing. You got series against the Rangers, a couple more against the Orioles, including today's series finale. You have the Indians mixed in there. So, look, the opportunity is there for the Yankees. The Rays don't seem to lose. They're now tied for the best record in all of Major League Baseball. And they're running away with the American League East. But the Yankees and the Red Sox are in a dogfight for who will host that wild card game. Right now, they're both somewhat comfortable. The Mariners and the A's are lurking in the wild card race. But right now, it's the Yankees and Boston. Will that wild card... I mean, and we haven't had that. We have not had a Yankees-Red Sox wild card game. I remember the first time they met in the playoffs. Well, they had the one-game playoff in 1978, the Bucky Dent game. The first time they actually met in the postseason was 1999, and that was such a powerhouse Yankees team, and they won in five games. The Red Sox were basically a one-man team that year with Pedro Martinez, which was the one game that Boston won in that series. Then we had the two classic postseason series in 2003-2004, both of which went the distance, and then the 2018 ALDS, which Boston won in four games in the Bronx. And we haven't had... Hey, the last winner-take-all Yankees-Red Sox game was Game 7 of 2004. Yankee fans remember that one, right? Kevin Brown, Javi Vasquez, Johnny Damon, David Ortiz. Ooh, that was a long time ago. That was a rough night.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
This time next week, these airwaves will have a completely different feel here on 98.7 ESPN New York. You'll have Dan Grasso and Greg Buttle getting a set for week one, Jets-Panthers from Carolina. See their old friend Sam Darnold. Bob Wischus and Marty Lyons will be on the call for that 1 p.m. kickoff, leading right into, for the rest of the football Sunday, Giants-Broncos at MetLife Stadium, a 4:25 kickoff, a legitimate chance, really, for both teams to get off to a good start this season, but especially the Giants. I mean, and I've spoken about this for weeks, the expectations aren't and shouldn't be there for the Jets just yet. But because we do like to play the expectations game, this week, ESPN.com did their NFL ceilings and floors for every team. And the beat reporter for each team for ESPN gave his or her synopsis of what the ceiling or floor should be. And Jordan Renan, who covers the Giants, says the Giants' ceiling this year is 10-7. If we're talking ceilings, to be honest, if you actually take a look at the Giants' schedule, I actually think their ceiling could be 11-6 because their schedule is not overly difficult. But 10-7, look, in the NFC East, with the unknown of Dak Prescott, with the Eagles in their current situation, and with the offensive limitations of the Washington football team, I think 10-7 wins you the NFC East. And again, I've been saying this for weeks, the Giants should come into this season expecting to win the NFC East. The Jets' expectation, their ceiling is actually 9-8, which, my God, 9-8, you need to erect a statue of Robert Saleh in front of MetLife Stadium. I mean, if you go 9-8, that means Zach Wilson looks as good as Justin Herbert did last year, or as good as Joe Burrow did before he was injured last season. And that would be a pretty special thing for the Jets. And it could happen. I mean, Zach Wilson has looked good during the preseason. I mean, he is, as far as a rookie quarterback can go, just based on seeing him play in the preseason games, I think if you're a Jets fan, you feel as good about your starting rookie quarterback as you possibly could going into week one. And it's also nice you're not playing one of the heavyweights in the NFL. So I know you're on the road, and Carolina should be an improved team, the quarterback position notwithstanding, in my opinion. You're not going on the road to play Tampa Bay or Baltimore or the Washington defense or somebody like that. But as far as the Giants go, let's be honest. I mean, if that's all you hear with the Giants, if they give Daniel Jones time, if the offensive line can give him enough protection, if he can take care of the football. And now, what are the storylines this week leading into the season opener on Sunday? Well, you know, Kadarius Toney has really not had a full preseason, so there's no chemistry there. Kenny Golladay has injured his hamstring, so there's not a lot of chemistry there. You haven't had Kyle Rudolph. We obviously know that Saquon Barkley hasn't played since week two of last season. So, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time for the chemistry to develop between Daniel Jones and all these offensive weapons. No, I'm sorry. This is the NFL regular season. And this is a franchise that has gone to the playoffs one time since 2011. That's a decade. You've gone to the playoffs once in a decade. And it's not like you were missing the playoffs by a game, even though you did last year. We're talking 4-12 seasons, 3-13, 5-11. We're talking a decade of ugly football. Even the one time you did go to the playoffs, it was an ugly playoff game. It was an ugly exit from the postseason in Green Bay, starting the week with the boat trip to Miami. So enough with the excuses. There's no time for Daniel Jones to get on the same page with his weapons. There's no time to develop that chemistry. That chemistry, whatever needs to happen to win week one, has to be there. Because the Giants have a golden opportunity to begin the season ahead of the curve, which I don't know the last time they did that. I mean, it seems like every year the Giants are 0-2, 1-3, 1-5. And then, oh, some signs of life. 2 out of 3 wins. So we go from 1-5 to 3-6. Okay, cool. We're going to build some momentum towards next year, and then next year we'll be ready to take that step. This is the year. This is next year. This is the year that you have to take that step. You've got everything in place. You have drafted where you want to draft for the last 5 years. Now, did you do a good job at that, Dave Gettleman? That's the issue here to me. If you look at Dave Gettleman's track record since he took over as the general manager, there have been quite a few hits. He's done very well, especially on the defensive side of the ball. How about Dexter Lawrence? 17th pick, got him as part of the Odell Beckham Jr. trade. That's a hit. O'Shane Zimenez in the third round. That's a hit. These guys are starting guys on the Giants' defense. Now, Saquon Barkley's a hit when he's healthy, and that's not going to be something I blame on the GM. Torn ACLs, especially from running backs, especially from skill position players in the NFL, they happen. But the two most important picks that Dave Gettleman has made, the jury is still very much out on Daniel Jones and Andrew Thomas, and they are both tied at the hip. They are the two most important draft picks that Dave Gettleman has made. He came in with all this bluster, talked about the hog mollies. He talked about Saquon Barkley wearing the gold jacket one day, which, based on his first two seasons, looked like he was right about that. But then his third season was not off to a good start, and then he got injured. But at the end of the day, it comes down to this offensive line and this quarterback. Now, do I think this quarterback can be a serviceable NFL quarterback if given time? Yes. But I also think that if you pick a guy number six in the draft at that position, you need to expect something more than him to be a serviceable NFL quarterback. I mean, we talk about ceilings. Is the ceiling for Daniel Jones to be the 15th best quarterback in the NFL? I think Giants fans would take that this year, but I don't think you want that for the next 5 years. I mean, you use that kind of draft capital at number six overall, especially in a season in which the following year, who got picked in the following year? Joe Burrow, Tua Tagovailoa, Justin Herbert. You knew those guys were coming. Maybe not necessarily Burrow. He was a late bloomer. You knew Tua was coming. You knew Justin Herbert was coming. Herbert would have been picked at the top of the draft in 2019 if he decided to come out and not return to Oregon. You knew those guys were coming. You did not need to pick Daniel Jones in 2019. That's the pick. That is the pick. We all know, right? That's everything that Gettleman does, the good, the bad, the ugly. The Daniel Jones is the centerpiece of everything he has and will do. And then because that's your pick, then the next year you pick number four and you've got to shore up that offensive line. Well, here's the problem with that, and it's only been one season, but Andrew Thomas has not had a very good preseason this year. Look at the offensive tackles who were picked in the first round in 2020. There were four of them that went in the top 13 picks. There was Andrew Thomas. There was Jedrick Wills to Cleveland, Mekhi Becton to the Jets, and Tristan Wirfs to Tampa Bay. Well, Pro Football Focus, they do a great job ranking every position in the NFL. And obviously they ranked all the offensive tackles. Of those four rookies, now second-year offensive tackles, the highest-rated one is Tristan Wirfs. He's been in the NFL for one season, and according to Pro Football Focus, he is already the sixth best offensive tackle in the NFL with a rating of 81.8. I can't tell you how they get to the rating. I don't know, but I'll give you some context in a moment. Tristan Wirfs' rating is 81.8. He is the sixth highest-rated offensive tackle in the NFL. Number one is David Bakhtiari, who's hurt now, but when the rankings came out, he was number one at 91.8. Wirfs was there for Gettleman to pick. Becton is the 29th ranked offensive tackle with a rating of 74.4. Jedrick Wills is 62.6, and Andrew Thomas is 62.4. You had a choice of four offensive tackles, and through a full season, and now through a second training camp, it seems that you have picked the worst one. And that is a huge problem. That is compounding already controversial pick from the year before, because who could you have had at number four in 2020? You could have had Justin Herbert. You could have had Tua Tagovailoa. You could have had the linebacker Isaiah Simmons, who I and a lot of people wanted the Giants to pick anyway. I mean, let's be honest. Since Gettleman took over on December 28th, 2017, the Giants have gone 5-11, 4-12, and 6-10. Last year, 6-10 felt a lot better for two reasons. Number one, the record itself was better, but number two, they were competitive in far more games. A lot of those 10 losses the Giants were competitive in, as opposed to the previous 2 years where the Giants were just getting blown off the field week after week after week. But his record overall is 15-33. The other reason for last year's improvement was Joe Judge, who you have to give credit to Gettleman for. But as I said, Gettleman is a controversial guy. The record indicates that he has done a bad job. 3 years is, it's not too short of a, too small of a sample size to start making judgments on somebody. Okay? But he hasn't done all bad things. He has had some hits in the draft and in free agency with James Bradberry and Logan Ryan, two key pieces of their defense. And then he's had some misses in free agency, like Nate Solder, who gets paid a ton of money and is starting the season as a backup. But I would imagine at some point we'll be back on the starting offensive line. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. But it all comes down to the number one pick in 2019, Daniel Jones, and this offensive line led by the number one pick in 2020, Andrew Thomas. And never mind the guys that you could have gotten instead of Daniel Jones. How about the guys that if you didn't pick a quarterback in 2019 because you didn't need to. You didn't need to. You could have squeezed one. You weren't going anywhere. You could have squeezed one more year out of Eli Manning. Your record would not have been that much better than it ended up being with Jones starting the final 14 games of the season, or the 12 of the final 14 games of the season. It wouldn't have been that much different. You still would have had a high pick in the 2020 draft. You knew that. But you had to pick Daniel Jones. So now it's year three for Jones. We've seen some good signs. We've seen more bad signs. His final preseason game last week against New England was typical Daniel Jones. For the first quarter and a half, he wasn't given enough protection. He finally started to move the ball a little, and then he makes that killer interception into the end zone. And then, just when you're ready to give up on this guy for the 17th time in his three-year career, he leads that beautiful drive where he goes no huddle, shotgun, right before the end of the half, leading to a beautiful touchdown pass, 23 yards. So you see the good, the bad, and the ugly of Daniel Jones, just like we've seen the good, the bad, the ugly of Dave Gettleman. But you've got to get rid of the ugly for Daniel Jones, and you need to reduce the bad. And I don't want to hear any more on how inexperienced he is. He started 26 games. This is not like it used to be when Phil Simms had to sit on the bench for 4 years before he was given the starting quarterback job. Daniel Jones has more NFL starts than Jalen Hurts, obviously Mac Jones and Zach Wilson, who are rookies. He's got more starts than Tua Tagovailoa, Joe Burrow, obviously Trevor Lawrence, Justin Herbert, Jacob Eason, who may start for Indianapolis in week one. He's got more NFL starts than him. That's like 7-8 starting quarterbacks who Jones has more experience than. Now, Mac Jones is on a team that's expected to go to the playoffs. Tua Tagovailoa is on a team that's expected to go to the playoffs. So is Justin Herbert. Those are rookies and second-year players. Jones is in his third season, and he has started every season of his NFL career. It's his third season as a starter. So enough with the kid gloves. Enough with, well, it's going to take time to adjust. You know what? You don't have time to adjust because you've got Denver, winnable game, and then a quick turnaround at Washington on Thursday night, winnable game, and then you're back home for Atlanta, winnable game. In the context of the rest of the Giants' schedule, those are winnable games. And you don't want to waste those first 3 weeks developing your chemistry with your new weapons. Because guess who's coming after that? You go to New Orleans. How does that usually work out for the Giants? I know Drew Brees isn't there anymore. Then you go to Dallas. Then you host the Rams. So after those first 3 weeks, the middle part of the schedule gets a lot tougher. You cannot throw away this opportunity the first 3 weeks to develop chemistry. You need to hit the ground running, and you need to start winning games because that's what it's all about. And if it's about Daniel Jones managing the game and letting the defense lead the way and minimizing his mistakes, if it's about leaning heavily on Saquon Barkley, which I know is risky because he's coming back from an injury, but whatever the strategy is, those first 3 games, you cannot throw away this opportunity to get off to a good start. Giants fans are so conditioned to playing from behind in a season after starting 0-2, 1-3, and looking for silver linings. After missing the playoffs by one game last season, there are no more silver linings. The silver lining is win the weakest division in the NFL and go to the playoffs and put up a fight when you get there.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.